No, I've been in Asia, as Nigel mentioned, for 15 years. And I think one thing I found, the big contrast, especially in the reinsurance world, coming back to North America, is that the North American context is still very much capacity and rate driven, where in Asia, a lot of the reinsurance is actually product driven. So for any of you that are actually in the reinsurance, you'll know that some of the companies like RGA, Swiss, Munich Re, they sort of built their business on a lot of product development support and product support. And I just remember making visits in Asia. A lot of times when you meet companies, the first thing they say to us, do you have new products for me? And then it's always like, okay, well, I don't have, let me see what I have in my pocket. And then in coming back to North America, especially my company, we do a lot of business in the US, it's all about, well, how cheap can you give me the rates, right? So it's quite a different contrast. What I plan to do today for my talk is actually just sort of walk you through the rationale in dealing with capital management deals in Asia. My company, when I was with Allianz Re and some with Gurley, we did, that was some of the kind of lines of business that we actually put our bet in. And so in my discussion, I'm going to go through a bit about, I'm just going to go through the rationale and talk a bit about what goes through the process from a perspective of a foreign reinsurer or with a company that is a European holding, and then working through this from an Asian perspective. When I was with Allianz, we reported into Munich, but my operation that I worked in was sitting in Singapore, and we dealt with the full Asia Pacific business. And so in these discussions, there's a lot of different animals, different moving parts that you have to deal with. Things from working on three regulatory fronts, right? So we had to deal with the regulatory front in whatever country we're working in, the regulatory front in Singapore, and the regulatory front in Germany. So this is just a bit of the agenda. I'm not going to go through it. The other thing, if you have any questions, I do encourage you to put up your hands, and if you want to, I have
a question.
Sure. Okay, sure. It's hard. Okay. I guess you're going to corral me into a claustrophobic situation here. Okay. All right. So I guess you can hear me better now. Okay. All right. Okay. This is just a table. I'm not going to go through each and every little point here, but it just gives you a bit of an idea of some of the issues that every time we assessed a capital management deal, whether they're cash or cashless, these are the issues that we have to deal with. So I sort of split up into three pillars, and I'm not talking about Solvency II here. So we look at first of all the company's financials, and if you just sort of bear that in mind, I'm going to go walk through an example in terms of how we look at it, and there's been cases where we actually declined deals because the financials just weren't strong enough. The underlying business we're looking at, whether it's pure mortality, whether it's morbidity, we found that a lot of things when I was in Asia, that a lot of the books of business is heavily weighted towards morbidity risks, right? So you have to sort of take a view on how you're going to model that business and what you're going to do in terms of where you think it's going to deteriorate at what point. So it's another aspect to look at. And obviously you have your risk transfer test because you have different regimes, accounting regimes that you have to deal with. Then as I mentioned earlier, when I was in Asia, we had to deal with three different balance sheets, right? So had to deal with the European balance sheet, the local domicile where we were located, and the domicile where the ceding company is located. So it just gives you an idea of the different aspects that we have to think about. Okay. Now, the other side of the coin is we also needed to look at different profit measures or drivers, what really drives this business, the source of income. Because in reality, we're there, reinsurance, you're there to make money, right? So we have that side of the coin that we have to look at. And so we had to deal with different things, return on risk adjusted capital. And being from with a European organization at the time, we had to deal with market consistent embedded value assessments. And we sort of warped that to new business margins that we had to deal with. And again, you'll see that in some of the examples that I'm going to pull up today. We also had to look at whether we would the deals are cash versus non-cash. In some jurisdictions in Asia, they still allow for certain non-cash transactions. It's just dependent on how you actually put the arrangements together. So there's still some allowance there. But by far, a lot of things, it's moving towards more funding. I think the beauty of being in the reinsurance market out of Asia, it's not as stringent in terms of the reinsurance credit perspective. Like, I now work in the U.S. markets, right? And now, with the U.S. side, you if you have an offshore reinsurer, you have to post letters of credit or collaterals or setting things up in 114 trusts. In Canada, if you're an offshore, you have your reinsurance security agreements to deal with. You have to set up collaterals and tri-party trust agreements, and it's quite hairy. But in Asia, a lot of the regulators, they just look, well, where's this reinsurer's home domicile? What's their capital base and what's their rating? So by virtue of that, you can transact reinsurance deals without having some of the headaches, I guess, that you deal with in the North American landscape, right? Or I'll just, can hit the next one. Okay. Well, this is sort of, just a bit of an alignment of, the presentation, you'll put it up on the website, or I don't know what you want to do with it. Okay, so again, I just sort of put there, I know some of my slides are quite wordy, and it just sort of gives you an idea of how we look at it. The top set of arrows in the dark blue is when we're assessing the basic the first line of assessment, right? Because that's sort of where we're going through. Well, we're looking at how the company's structured. We're looking at what exactly this company wants, right? Do they need funding? Is it purely for solvency relief? And we look at whether the underwriting philosophy of that company's aligned with the company that you represent, because you need to have an alignment to sort of understand, like, are you looking at the risk in the same perspective? Is there enough interest for the company to manage that risk going forward? Because a lot of these transactions that occur, you sort of put a lot of faith that on the small minor levels of managing the day-to-day of the business is managed effectively, because you're really looking at aggregate cash flows and you're really looking at everything in aggregates, right? Because you're looking at balance sheet impact and you're looking at income statements. So you're not as concerned. But if a portfolio is not managed effectively from the ground up, then it could skew and you could have adverse experience. And then you could come up with a loss or never recover your funding, right? And then the lower line, the light blue line, is sort of, once we've assessed it, is it just a pure cashless transaction or a cash transaction? If it's a cash transaction, then we have to look at other different things like gearing, like if there's funding that's required, right? And there's a different treatment on the balance sheet on how that's when you're using a reinsurance mechanism. And you have to look at, well, what point in time that you're going to recover your money, right? So you're almost looking like that as a venture capitalist when you start doing the funding, okay? Any questions so far? Someone? All right, I'm just going to jump a bit into the regulatory environment. And I just sort of picked, because you'll see the reason why I picked those three jurisdictions is because my examples I'm going to pull up are actually from these three jurisdictions, okay? As I mentioned, most of the countries, whether you name it Taiwan, China, Korea, Singapore, wherever, they all have a minimum rating. So the reinsurer is to operate as an offshore reinsurer without having to have a physical domicile there, whether it's a branch or a subsidiary. You can function in those markets with an A rating or better. Okay, so that's basically what it is. So and you don't need to post letters of credit and all that. As long as you have that rating, and there may be questions from some of the regulators, they want you to demonstrate that, and they may require you to provide your company financials, your most recent audited statements and everything. But in general, that's really what you need to do. Okay. You'll notice that some the jurisdictions, like China and Taiwan, they follow a U.S. style kind of valuation. So it's your standard, sort of like your CRVM setups of a net level premium reserve with some full preliminary term. So, and it's on a prescribed basis. Where Singapore, interestingly, their valuation basis is very close to Canadian GAAP. So, you know, you still have to model your cash flows and you best estimate plus PADs and all that. And then you basically model every with the PADs that's supposed to cover 75% of standard deviation. You model your solvency capital based on what your 99.5% VAR. So, the interesting thing, the reason why Singapore has a sort of like a C gap kind of a Canadian gap kind of model, is because at one time the assistant director of insurance for under the MAS. He was actually a guy named John Palmer, and he's ex-OSFI. So that's sort of when that all happened, that was sort of when the changes started coming in with the way Singapore is looking at things. Most of the jurisdictions, China now has it, Taiwan has it, Singapore has it. They have guidelines on how you should be conducting reinsurance, and they also have guidelines in terms of how companies should be managing their reinsurance. And they also have guidelines on financial reinsurance or finite reinsurance. So, but a lot of them have adapted basically the International Association, IAIS, of insurance supervisors. They came up with a paper, six, seven years ago. And then the IAIS guidelines have been more or less adapted by a lot of the Asian jurisdictions. In Taiwan, they're still following a bulk standard, U.S.-style standard model risk-based capital. And I'll show it later, and I have some interesting stories to tell you on that. And in China, they were to this point, they're still following the old European Solvency I rules of a per mil sum at risk and a X percent of reserves. I think it's 3 per mil and 4% of reserves or something. For their solvency basis, and Singapore, as I mentioned, it's more like an MCCSR kind of setup. So that's just basically a quick snapshot of the different regulatory regimes that I'm going to be talking about, and you'll see why I just sort of picked those three, because as I said, it relates to the examples I'm going to have. This is just a bit more in terms of an insight of the cycle that we have to deal with every time we look at these arrangements, right? So when I was with Allianz, we had to look at from the perspective, okay, we're sitting there as an offshore reinsurer, the minimum rating for a reinsurer. The reserve credit aspect. So for example, it's up in the other slide. China... they only allow a 90% reserve credit for offshore reinsurers. Okay, so if you're a domiciled branch and you're reinsuring a Chinese book of business, you can get full credit for their reserves ceded. If you're an offshore, they only give you 90% credit. So then you have to figure out, you know, interesting ways to try and shore up that extra 10% of reserves, and sometimes it could be quite a big hit. Okay, you have to look at, you know, as I mentioned, you have to look at what the financial reinsurance regulations in all jurisdictions are, right? Then from that perspective, then we had to look at it from a branch side. The MAS 114 is the guidelines, which is the same as the OSFI B3 guidelines, on prudent management of reinsurance. But the interesting with the MAS 114, they also have guidelines inside there in terms of the risk transfer tests, right? So what you need to do and how you have to demonstrate risk transfer on these transactions. Or the regulator could actually tell you to unwind the transactions, even though you're assuming the business. We had to look at the difference there. There was usually some arbitrage because you'd have in one jurisdiction using a prescribed basis, and then another jurisdiction you could apply when you're setting up your reserving, say if you're using an original terms kind of deal, you would basically have the arbitrage of setting up your reserves on a best estimate plus PAD perspective, which there's some arbitrage there. Your local solvency impact, and then the auditors. I don't know how it is here now, but in Asia, I found that the auditors take on a lot bigger role. So the regulators actually depend a lot on the auditors and on the audit statements that they're sort of policing that this company is doing the right thing. So the auditors in Asia have a lot more clout than what I remembered when I was working in North America. It might be different now, but I haven't dealt with the auditors now because now I work in a consulting intermediary outfit. Right? Then in head office, I guess just hold that thought because we had to deal with German GAAP, which was another interesting animal. They look at things a bit differently from a Singapore perspective. And then we also had to deal with a consolidation on IFR statements. And then the Solvency II impact, more on the quantitative side, so the Pillar 1 stuff, and then, again, auditors. So that's just a bit of a cycle that we have to look at when we're doing these kind of deals. Okay. Again, this is probably some motherhood stuff, and with being a publicly traded company, we always had to abide by the accounting rules and making sure that everything we did was above water. So we had to look at a thing. We had to deal with the IFRS 4 perspective of things. So effectively, what constitutes an insurance contract? You had to deal with the risk transfer. You had to look at whether there's significant insurance risk. You know, if you can bifurcate contracts, you needed to do that. So if it's clear that a contract has a pure insurance risk mechanism, and you can actually bifurcate, say, a loan mechanism if you're doing funding, then you needed to do that. Then we also had to look at it from a FAS 113 aspect, so the reinsurance accounting perspective. My colleagues in Germany used to mention, they used to say to me, they had this funny saying. They said, we work under an IFRS environment, but with a GAAP framework. A U.S. GAAP framework, which was really bizarre. So a lot of times, what happens is if something you're looking at doesn't really answer your questions under IFRS 4, then you had to jump to a U.S. GAAP rules. So that's why we always had to deal with the FAS 113 on the reinsurance accounting perspectives. The big thing was always how do you demonstrate risk transfer, what is considered a long-term contract, short-term contract, all that. So that always fell under a U.S. GAAP kind of view. Then we also had to deal with this 93.6, which was, retrospective rated contracts. Because there were contracts that went around the market at one time when they were sort of back looking at losses, and the reinsurer would sort of pay the losses now that something happened over in the past, and they basically amortize it over time for insurance companies. So those are retrospective rated contracts. You can't do those kind of things. So there's a lot of different animals that you have to sort of go through each of those components to make sure that you are compliant, right? And again, working for a publicly traded company at the time, they're and a German company, They're sticklers on that. They're very tight on making sure you comply regulatorily. They're very tight on what the auditors say, and so I would spend reams and reams of time on conference calls with my colleagues in Munich. And the weirdest thing with them is that we were a 6 to 7 hour difference from Munich, but for some reason they would still set up conference calls for me at 3 o'clock in the afternoon German time. So it'd be like I'd be talking with calls about till 10 o'clock, starting at 10 till midnight. And I just remember one time I was so frustrated, and I wasn't good because I was surprised I wasn't fired. The talk just kept, the conversation kept going circular. And I finally said to my boss in Munich, I just said, I don't understand why you don't understand. And then the conversation ended right there. And they said, Mr. Lum, I suggest we put that on an email and we can talk again. So I said, okay. I surprised because I was so frustrated. It was like closing at 1 in the morning. I was sitting there for 2.5 hours already on a call. And it just wasn't going anywhere. So that was a bit brutal. So that's what happens when you work for working in Asia for companies that are abroad in Europe or anything. Okay. Right there. Okay. This is again. I'll go into detail. I'm sort of going through all of this stuff and just to sort of tee up my thought process and my company's thought process and when we're looking at these kind of transactions in Asia, right? So again, we relied a lot on the risk transfer tests on the FAS 113 aspects. But the only problem there was, and it always became a discussion with the regulators and auditors, how do you define risk transfer, right? Everyone always used that rule of the 10% probability of a 10% loss, right? And so it became, it's a very tough discussion, especially when you're dealing with life reinsurance or any biometric risk business, because sometimes it's the reason why you do these deals is because you're looking at it from a perspective that you have a pretty decent chance of making back your money that you put in your investment in and then making a gain on it, right? So to actually start demonstrating, a 10% loss, a 10% probability of a 10% loss, it becomes very difficult. So you have to sort of go through a lot of statistical analysis and justification. And so, you look at different aspects of your loss in terms of timing of cash flows and your loss in terms of your ultimate loss. So you have to play around with lapse assumptions, mortality. But we found that a lot of times, and yield, right, if you're doing original term kind of deals, right? So you have to play around with different aspects to try and get to that demonstration of the 10-10 rule, which I say, right? So one thing is they look at it as a product of both. So you can sort of try and get there. And I can tell you there are times where it's very difficult that it just takes, reams of documents going back and forth with auditors and the regulators and working in the Singapore environment, the regulators are very, very hands-on. As a foreign reinsurer in that market, you get audited by the regulator every 2 years. So they have a cycle. And they have this. They also have this internal rating system of reinsurers in the market. It's not public, but they disclose it to you as the reinsurance company where you lie in their rating system. And then sometimes if they think it's too twitchy, like during the 2011 catastrophes, Tohoku or Fukushima in Japan, the Thailand floods, the earthquakes in Christchurch or Auckland, in New Zealand, a lot of the companies in Asia were especially some of the reinsurers that were sitting in some of the Asian jurisdictions, although they were backed by their parent, they had certain pots of cash to pay claims, right? So they actually had to push more capital into some of the branch operations. And during that period, some of the companies, the the regulator was making regular visits, and they wanted a monthly solvency report. So it can get very they can get under your skin quite easily, and then when they do audit you, you actually have to set aside a certain amount of offices for them to sit in there, and they'll sit in your offices for what, 2 months, and they'll just walk into your office and you can't say anything. They just walk in your office and, can I ask you something? And you just go, okay, I guess, you know, either that or I'm going to get caned, right? So one or the other. So again, this is just a bit more of a bit of an insight. Okay. All right, I'm just going to jump a bit into the different transactions that I've seen, and I'm going to go through. I'm just going to grab some water here. I'm just going to go through a couple of cashless transactions, and then a funding transaction, just so you can get a flavor of what we, you know, when we deal these, when the kind of deals you see in Asia, and sort of what's out there and what can be done, right? This first transaction comes out of Taiwan, and this was purely a cashless transaction. It's purely a solvency play, right? And this one smells arbitrage all over the place, right? I know it's a funny word to say, but it is what it is, right? So effectively, what companies are allowed to do in Taiwan is that they can actually reinsure huge quota shares of their one-year business. And that one-year business is made up of accident stuff, hospital cash stuff, you know, short-term, one-year term life. So there's a mix of group business in there also. And what these companies do is the way they manage their solvency from a year-to-year perspective. And there are companies that write large books of that. You know, and there's some companies that write like big books of travel PA, and it's under life companies, right? So what they do is there's two animals when they actually have to sit there and they have to set up reserves for it. One is obviously the UPRs or your URRs that you have to set up for this business. The other side is what they called was a special claims reserve or a contingency reserve. And it was kind of a weird rule. What you had to do was, it was always done in arrears. So you look at your experience from the previous year and your actual to expected, right? You're supposed to take the difference between your actual and expected and then multiply it by 40%. And you have to hold that reserve for the upcoming year. So you can imagine it becomes quite a pretty big hit on terms of your capital to manage this year-to-year business, right? So what they did was, these companies, they go, okay, I need to find a reinsurer that can, sorry, I should be talking behind here, I shouldn't talk. So what they do is, these companies, they basically need to find a reinsurer just to write a year, annual renewable reinsurance contract. That's all it is. And then for these kind of deals, they do get very competitive, because reinsurers, when these deals first came out, reinsurers used to charge a spread of about 100 basis points, right? And sometimes maybe a bit higher. But now, when by the time I left Asia, there was about 50 basis points. And this is an example of one where we had to charge about 50 basis points, primarily because of the competitive nature of it, right? Now, in this structure, right, if we would have classified this as a pure bulk standard reinsurance risk rate transaction, we would never be able to meet the 50 basis points charge for the risk charge. So how we had to look at this deal was we sort of deconstructed, looking at from purely from a substance versus form kind of view. And under Solvency II, right, there's several different aspects you need to look on, the quantitative aspect, you know. If you're writing, you have to look at market risks, liquidity risks, operational risk, insurance risk, and credit risk. Okay, so this one purely, we looked at it purely because there's no market risk, because we're not taking on any assets, right? There's no liquidity risk because there's nothing behind that. There's no credit risk because we're not funding anything. And then the operational risks, you know, you're looking at lapses and all those kind of things, and that doesn't really come into play. So what really comes into play is purely your one-year mortality risk, or we call it the non-hedgeable risk. So in the Solvency II model, they have three aspects of when you're looking at any biometric risk. One is a calamity aspect. So what in a one-year scenario, what's the worst case that could happen? So on back then it was a 99.93 VAR. And then the other thing is you're looking at morbidity and mortality in terms of level mispricing. And then you also look at trend, right? So being it's 1 year, we could disregard the level mispricing issue. We could disregard the trend. So the only thing we needed to really look at it was from a perspective of a calamity. Okay, so effectively what we did was we broke down all the risks. We looked at the year-to-year experience. And as I mentioned there, for the past 5 years, the loss ratios for that business range from 40 to 70%. And if you break it down from each risk, you basically look at a variance of each risk. And then we effectively took a very simplistic view. We almost looked at everything as you either claim or you don't. So it's a binomial distribution kind of setup to develop what our variance is. Then from there, we just basically modeled it. And we looked at it from a 99.3 tail. And because the risk was performing so much, the underlying claims was performing so much better than below the underlying premiums that they're collecting. And these deals are basically on gross terms. But it's gross one-year terms, right? Effectively, your risk-adjusted capital on a 99.93 basis was an extra 1.3 million euros on this deal. And then when we collected a risk margin of 156,000 euros. You can just do the math and you can see the risk-adjusted the return on risk-adjusted capital is 12%. So again, this structure, you know, from if you're taking on from a straightforward view of reinsurance, you're not going to be able to do it. So this kind of arrangement, and none of the local reinsurers could do it because they would fall under the same rules as the direct company. So being an offshore, this one's just pure arbitrage, right? And so that's one way we looked at it, right? And looking at the different jurisdictions you need to do. Yeah. Under premium reserve. Now, this is a second. Taiwan allows you to do a lot of cashless transactions. This one again is a pure play on the solvency RBC rules. Okay, this was a structure on a long-term health. When Taiwan, their long-term health. I'll give you a bit of background. Taiwan has a national healthcare system, and under the National Health Insurance (NHI), there's co-pays enveloped inside in the national healthcare scheme. So what happened was the market, they came up with a hospital cash and surgical lump sum products, primarily to cover the gap in the co-pays, right? And so there is a bit of anti-selection with this business because people would buy multiple policies. You don't have anything like what you would see in the North American context where, you know, you have MIB systems in the US where you can actually check whether people are insured for multiple policies or anything. So a lot of people would buy multiple policies and they would use it almost like they check themselves in the hospital for like a hotel and they collect the benefit. So there you have to be careful, and this is where the aspects of looking at it from the morbidity to the deterioration aspect, right? This book of business was primarily long-term cancer and hospital income policies, okay? And the way you structured these deals again was you write the business on your book, and then you give them a high profit share back. So in this one, it was 90% in excess of 5% reinsurer's expenses. Okay, and this is another interesting scenario. It's just purely playing with the rules of what you're given under a solvency regime. That's all we're doing, right? I do have an interesting point here. You see where I said the formula of the RBC, of the C risk there? This 48 is an interesting story. When Taiwan first said they want to adopt a risk-based capital formula or basis for solvency capital, they originally came up, they said, oh, let's look at what the U.S. is doing. Let's just take their model and straight up apply the coefficients, not really understanding what's really behind why these coefficients were and what the real edict was to try and get to your certain VAR, right? So when they applied it first straight up, they did their sort of like a quiz, right? A quantitative impact study. They found that four out of every five local insurance companies were insolvent under the rule. So then the regulators started scrambling. They didn't really want to change their basis. Then they introduced the K factor. And then that K factor was actually lower, but it's moving up over time. And when I left, it was 0.48. And I think the next move is 0.55 or something. I think they've implemented, but I'm not too sure. So that's what that 0.48 is at the front. So it's just this K factor that the regulator said, oh, this is really embarrassing that all our local companies are actually insolvent under this new solvency regime. So let's just introduce this K factor. So it's quite interesting how you see this. And so that's why I think in certain ways it's fun to work in Asia in that landscape. But some other ways you're sort of scratching your head how regulators look at things. There was a case when I was in with Brunei. They had an international insurance conference, and 3 weeks before, they never had any insurance regulations. 3 weeks before the conference, they decided to put out their insurance regulations, and in it there was a bunch of references to, because we're asked to review it, my company, and when there was a bunch of references that you go and look for appendixes, and they weren't there in the regulations. So they sort of just picked and choose what they want and just put it together, which is kind of interesting the way they work. So in the Asian context, so from there it was quite different when I moved out to Asia a little bit. So in this whole animal, we just played purely with the C2 part of the component of the risk-based capital, which was purely the amount of capital you have to put aside for accident and health policies, right? So it's just purely a peer coefficient against the reserve, and then they can take credit for the ceded portion of the risk, as long as the reinsurer has enough credit rating and so on and so forth. I know I should. I know it's 7:05, so I better speed this up a bit here. Everyone's hungry here. This again. It's just a bit of a view in terms of the overall impact of the cost, right? So I guess I should just draw you to the bottom part in terms of where what drove the insurance company to why this deal made sense for them. If you look at the bottom in terms of the risk-based capital savings, right? And you'll see on the bottom part right here, you'll see the present value of the future risk-based capital savings, and you look at the present value of the reinsurance costs. So right there, it drives the CFO of the organization to say, hey, this is a good deal, right? And then from our perspective, as long as we made our hurdles, and we would do the deals. And the beauty of these, as I said, they're non-cash, right? We do have to deal, if it is a true risk, if it deteriorates, then we could be in trouble, right? Any questions? Okay, all right. Okay. So those were two non-cash arrangements. This now I'm gonna go a bit into I know this is a wordy thing. But I'm not going to go everything through this. But these are the standard kind of embedded value transactions you see in Asia. And I'm going to take an example from China. There is still a lot of... I can tell you, if you're ever planning to go to Asia to work, right? There's still a lot of... there's still a lot of opportunities in terms of writing embedded value transactions in China. The only thing that you have to worry about is well, if it's a worry or not, right? And this is sort of where the view is: you can't take your standard practices that when you're looking at the deals in North America versus a similar deal in Asia, right? Especially in the whole China regime. What happens is a lot of these transactions occur because a lot of these Chinese companies, they're owned by in joint ventures. A lot of them, you'll notice, if you go through right now a list of the insurance companies that are besides the big ones like your CPICs, your China Lifes, your Ping Ans and PICCs, all those guys. If you look at a lot of the joint ventures, you'll see a lot of these companies, they actually are owned by construction companies. They're partially owned by construction companies, partially owned by real estate companies. And there's a bit of a view where and it happens a bit in Taiwan too, where a construction company or a real estate company will actually create a joint venture. And what they do is they then use effectively the policyholder's money, and they back the assets by buying the real estate assets back from the construction company or the real estate company, which is pretty brutal because you're sitting there with a possible stale book of assets. Then you have a liquidity risk issue, right? But you take a squinty eyed look at that. The other aspect though is that the regulator CIRC, they don't want to be embarrassed because they've sort of opened up their doors to in terms of the economics of the world, and they're sort of saying they're trying to showcase, right? And the last thing they want to do is allow a Chinese joint venture or any company in China to go under. So then they allow a fair amount of a bit more flexibility in terms of how companies can fund, right? So that's sort of where in these kind of transactions, there's a fair amount of interaction with the insurance companies, with the regulators, and with the auditors. Yes.
One question here: what do you mean by embedded value transaction?
Okay, sure.
How is it different from the
transaction? Okay, this one is a pure cash deal, right? So you're taking a view. So what you're doing is you're monetizing the future value of that block of business today. So it's a two-headed monster. So you have one aspect where it's pure cash. So you're monetizing the future value of that block. So you're saying, I believe it's worth so much. And the other side is the offset in terms of the due to the cessions in terms of the solvency capital and the reserve credit. So when I say it's an embedded value transaction, it's purely just monetizing the future value. Yeah. Okay. When you're looking at these kind of transactions, right, you still want to have again, as a business, you're there to make money. You're not there to be a charity, right? So you pay a lot of attention not just to the financials of the company. You also pay attention to other things that you can do. Like, for example, you look at your gearing ratios, right? So you look at what the intrinsic value of that block of business is, but you're not going to loan more than 50 to 60% of that value, right? Because you want to have a higher likelihood of at least recovering your initial cash outlay, right? The other things you can get away with, and it's becoming more of a tougher situation, but when I was in Asia and we're doing these transactions, we actually embedded a investment income hedge inside the contract. So we could, and the regulators allowed it at that time. I think they're now changing it. Like, for example, if I do a bulk standard co-insurance funds withheld transaction in the US, there's no way in heck that the regulator would allow me to put in a peg on the yield, right? They wouldn't allow me to do that. But in the transactions in Asia, I can get away with it. I can sit there and say, okay, your prescribed basis is 2.5%. Therefore, I want a floor in the yield of 2.5%. and then we'll have some type of profit share trigger in terms of the generation above the 2.5. So effectively, if you can imagine when I pump it through my Solvency II model, I actually have embedded an embedded option in there, right? So you can get away with these kinds of things. And that's why I'm saying that the regulator, because of certain things that happen in China, they're more willing to think about these and accept these kind of terms on the contract. Okay. Again, you can't get away with it out here again in the market. You actually can charge a borrowing cost on the amount of capital outlay you have, right? And so a lot of companies take a view of some type of weighted adjusted cost of capital. So they might say, okay, if I had to issue subordinated debt, if I loaned out, I bought subordinated debt, I would expect X return on subordinated debt, and I would expect X return on my equities. So then they'll come up with some blend. They might say, our portfolio is 30-70, so therefore we want a weighted adjusted cost of capital. And so effectively, that is my borrowing rate. So in this example, you'll see the borrowing rate was pretty high. You can't get away with it out here. This example is 8%. So you could charge a borrowing rate on the cash outlay of 8%, which it's quite a big impact in your profitability of your business. The only thing you have to deal with is, which is interesting, and I'll deal with, I'll mention that a bit later on, is the Forex risk. Because you might be, say, I needed to fund, in the case of my organization, we had euros, right? So we'd have to sort of say, okay, we need to convert euros to renminbi in China, and then you had the aspect of the non-convertible issues of the Chinese yuan, and the controls on the currency from the SAFE. So that becomes an added complexity on how you're going to construct these deals. Okay, again, I'm not going to go into this because I just look at the time, but this is just basically a cash flow thing. You can just sort of see how your transactions work. I'm going to skip that, and you can look at it when you look at the handouts of it. But it's pretty bulk standard in terms. Effectively, we're just looking at original terms cash flows. Okay. This is a bit more in terms of the different aspects that we had to look at. It's a reverse credit risk now, right? Because now you're actually loaning, putting money out there. You're actually funding another company. So when you have so now you have to look at it from the other aspect. Is okay? You're almost taking a view like a bank. What's my chances of recovery? Will I be able to get that money back? How long do I think I'll be able to recover my initial outlay? Right? So you have to sort of think about these kind of aspects. So when you look at embedded value transactions, you're almost turning the tide around and you're sort of throwing out your view from a conventional reinsurance aspect. You're almost looking at this as venture capital, right? I expect a certain amount of yield, i.e. my weighted adjusted cost of capital, right? How long is it going to take me to get my money back? I want to know that, or if I don't, what's the downside? Will I ever get it back? Could I lose it all? Could I get a portion of it? How long will it take, right? So again, these are just a bit of the aspects. And so lapses come into play a lot. These deals become very sensitive to lapses. These deals actually become relatively sensitive to yield, right? Because if I took out that hedge, that internal hedge into the contract, I would be it impacts it quite a bit. It's very sensitive to that. Okay? All right. Okay, so this is just an example of an embedded value transaction. So what drove this company was they needed actually a couple things. They needed to maintain their capital adequacy ratio under the Chinese regime of 150%. So it's the standard what everyone follows, right? If you hit 150 or higher, the regulator leaves you alone. But if you get between 100 to 150, then they start intervening, and if it's below 100 and below, then they take over, right? So it was just and that was basically what they drove the company. They also needed some working capital, so that's why they needed to look at it from a cash transaction perspective. It was just a pure simple co-insurance funds withheld structure. So effectively, it's original terms, quota share deal, and the assets backing the liabilities are withheld by the seeding company, and they manage that asset, and they just credit a yield back to you, back into the structure. As I mentioned earlier, it was purely to monetize the future profits of the book, okay? And we also, in this transaction, because we didn't want to really participate in the future expenses, we actually took a view of their assumptions and we monetized their expenses up front. So then in the future, we would get the premiums, pay the claims, and change in reserves, but we wouldn't participate in expenses. So that's sort of the underlying structure. As I mentioned, it was a combination of cash and reinsurance credit. And again, this is just to give you an idea of the things we looked at, right? So we purely did look at it from a perspective of an investment. And so you notice here I mentioned that the contract, our weighted adjusted cost of capital is 8%. So the IRR is on a pure cash basis. So this is the cash we gave out. Are we going to make our money back, right? So yes, we did, because it's very simple, because we looked at different scenarios that if they recapture, because you can put in recapture clauses in the contracts as long as it's one way, so the ceding company can recapture, but not the reinsurer cannot invoke recapture. So we just sort of looked at different scenarios that if the moment that the money's paid off, will we make our money back? So, you know, you can see from the IRR perspective, we've made the weighted adjusted cost of capital requirements. And then the other measure is looking from a new business margin perspective. And again, it was a pretty strong contract. It was a pretty strong transaction. And then at the end of the day, the capital adequacy ratio for the company went up from 108% to 189%. So they managed to get their what they needed. The only other thing that they do have in the rules that you have to be careful when you're doing these kind of deals is the regulator does look at how much reinsurance is ceded in aggregate. So they usually use the 50% rule under two aspects. One is on premium and one is on reserves. So as long as it fulfills that, and I must say this transaction itself, it was actually bordering right on it, because from a premium perspective, it was 41%. And from a reserve perspective, it was 49%. So it was bordering on that. So this company probably couldn't do too much more unless their business grew to another point. Okay. The last is just an example so this is just one that didn't work, right? And this one didn't even go into the whole numerics. This was purely from the due diligence aspect. So when we went in, we talked to this company. So again, and with the information they gave us, we just felt that it was not a good risk. A couple things that sort of hit us there was the without the capital injection, they could fall below 100%. So that's already a red flag there. The other aspect was their mismatch between their assets and their liabilities. So there was the liabilities had an average duration of 12.8 years, and the assets was 6.3. So you have this massive possible reinvestment risk there, right? And then the other part that sort of got us a bit, well, twitchy, why we walked away, was there was a large portion of their assets, roughly about 20% of it, was invested in real estate, which was quite illiquid, right? So that this is a case where my organization, we walked away because we just said it just didn't make sense, and we really looked at it like a venture capital, and we just said, you know what, we just don't feel that it's tight enough in order for us to make money. Okay. And that's it. And by the way, this is a photo of Glutton's Bay. This is this place in Singapore that has this. It's right beside the Esplanade, that sort of like that durian shaped theater, and then they have this hawker stalls outside. So. Okay. Any questions? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so it looks at, so the 50% rule is from a gross perspective. So they look at how much reinsurance premium is seeding out, and if a company does a lot of co-insurance deals, that will hit pretty quickly. And so, and then to the aggregate gross premium is the collection. So in this case, this company, they were 41%. And then the other rules, they look at the aggregate reserves, and they look at the amount of ceded reserves. And then, yeah, so they're just... Pardon?
Is the 50% rule is relative to the ceding company total reserves?
Yeah.
That's right.
But most jurisdictions, they do keep an eye on it. They do look at if companies are ceding too much. They do, because then they start boring those as a fronting company. So
what's the
future Okay, so a lot of these books of business, that one transaction example was, we normally look for recovery within about 8 years, but this one was a bit longer, it was like 12.3 years of recovery. But a lot of the books of business, they write a lot of term, and a lot of term, I mean sort of whole life, so a lot of whole life and endowment business. So the durations are like 20, 30 years. Longer. And a lot of them have a lot of riders on top of it. So if one animal can ride in terms of this, like this is really long range business. And you generally want to get a recovery period of about 8 years. But this one was we went 12.3 because we just talked about it.
There has been a hot topic on alternative capital coming into the market. That's more on the P&C side. How is that impacting the life side, particularly in Asia-Pac? Like, I know in like, Bermuda, that's being kicked pretty hard.
The alternative capital markets haven't really hit in the Asian market. You don't really see that because, again, there's a few things, right?
What is the question?
Alternative capital. So basically, I'll come. I have this habit of walking around.
So sorry.
I have to be.
So Nigel, okay. Would you like to?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so Nigel was asking about the whole aspect of alternative capital, which you're sort of seeing this movement in the North American context, right? And it's actually driving a lot of the soft markets. It's helping drive the soft markets, and it's actually shortening the cycles on the non-life perspective. You really don't see a lot of the alternative capital hitting the Asian market right now, primarily because, you know, the books of business are not as huge. You don't see really, really huge books of business unless you're talking Japan or Korea, right? But in general, you're not going to see that movement in there. And there still is very much a view in terms the regulators get a bit twitchy with anything that is possibly synthetic or anything that's alternative where there's actually a true backing of it, right? But there is you're starting to see there are captive setups. But primarily, some of the captive setups are primarily internal with companies because they want to sort of pawn off certain risks, maybe on the employee benefit side. But no, it's not really a movement that you're seeing right now in Asia. Not even on the P&C side. No. You don't have that kind of stuff where like hedge funds will take books of annuities, right? And they basically want to grab the asset. Because first of all, they can't grab the asset because the regulator does not like you to touch that stuff, right? Because the main thing, the biggest thing with regulators is they want to make sure, they really are really sticky about making sure the asset stays on shore. So because if something really happens, then at least they can tap into it and they can control it. Yeah. So I hope I answered your question. Yes, yes, Paul.
Ebola in the new column every day.
Yeah.
What happened if you get out of control?
I presume, listen, I was in Asia during the SARS period, right? And during the SARS period, interesting things came about. You know, aside from the isolation, and I have to say, Singapore did a heck of a job because there's an island, and they could ring fence it pretty quickly. During that phase, there was a lot of panic, and I just remember we got a lot of questions on can we cover pandemic risk and all that, right? I don't know. I'm not an expert to say whether it is something that's there that's going to happen. But the longer it gets on, there'll be questions about pandemic risk. There'll be questions as whether companies have sufficient capital to cover that. But in all honesty, I always looked at it, if there truly is a pandemic like that, the last thing anyone cares about is trying to collect on their insurance benefits, because there'll be no one around, because no one would even want to go outside of their house, right? So I just remember when during SARS, my wife and I, we leave our kids at home, we go grocery shopping, and normally in Singapore, you never see the malls are empty. I'm serious. You walk and you're just walking free, can do it, buy your stuff. And when no one talks to anyone, you get home, you just change all your clothes and you take a shower, that's it, right? And that's how it was. And going to the work, everyone sort of, I come to the office, I don't go near anyone, I just said, hi, morning, go to my office, close the door. And if people want to talk to me, say, people will just call you or write you an email. But I don't know. I really don't know. But the other interesting thing we found, which was, because all this stuff happened in hospitals, right, and people were afraid of infection, the actual incidence rate of hospitalization went down because no one wanted to go to the hospital. Yeah, so that was another interesting aspect, you see. So I can't really answer that, Paul. I'm not an expert, but I just sort of what I observed on that. Yeah. So, all right. Well, thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Doug, for such an informative and educational presentation. We're going to have the slides and also the audio recording up on our website after the meeting. And then we also have a prize draw, grand prize draw, which is a Vitamix blender at around 9:30. So stick around after dinner. And then we also have a table prize draw after that as well. So without further waiting, let's get the dinner started.